self-controlled, but also happily absorbed in an activity. Before, it was sage like a picture. Now it's sage and awakened, explained the French psychologist and writer Maryse Vaillant, herself a member of the famous Generation of 68. Into this generational upheaval walked Françoise Dotto, the other titan of French parenting. French people I speak to, even those without kids, can't believe that Americans haven't heard of Françoise Dotto, or that only one of her books has ever been translated into English. It is long out of print. In France, Dotto is a household name, a bit like Dr. Benjamin Spock used to be in the United States. The centenary of her birth was celebrated in 2008 with a flood of articles, tributes, and even a made-for-TV movie about her life. UNESCO convened a 3-day conference on Dotto in Paris. Her books are for sale in practically every French bookshop. In the mid-1970s, Dotto was in her late 60s and was already the most famous psychoanalyst and pediatrician in France. In 1976, a French radio station began broadcasting daily 12-minute programs in which Dotto responded to listeners' letters about parenting. "Nobody imagined the immediate and lasting success of the program," recalled Jacques Pradel, then its 27-year-old host. He describes her responses to readers' questions as brilliance, bordering on premonition. "I don't know where she got her answers," he says. When I watch film clips of Dotto from that period, I can see why she appealed to anxious parents. With her thick glasses and matronly outfits, she had the bearing of a wise grandmother. The famous person she most resembles is Golda Meir, and like her American counterpart, Dr. Spock, Dotto had the gift of making everything she said, even her more outrageous claims, sound like common sense. Dotto may have looked like everyone's grand-mère, but her message about how to treat kids was deliciously radical and fitting for the new times. In a sort of emancipation of babies, she claimed that even infants are rational, and indeed, that they understand language as soon as they're born. It's an intuitive, almost mystical message, and it's a message that ordinary French people still embrace, even if they don't all articulate it exactly. Once I read Dotto, I realize that so many of the most curious claims that I've heard French parents make, like the one that you're supposed to talk to babies about their sleep troubles, come straight from her. Dotto's radio broadcasts made her into an almost mythic figure in France. Well into the 1980s, books containing transcripts of the broadcasts and other conversations were stacked like produce in French supermarkets. A whole cohort of children were known as Génération Dotto. A psychoanalyst quoted in a special Dotto-themed edition of Télérama magazine in 2008, recalled riding in a taxi whose driver said he never missed the radio show. "He was dumbfounded," he said. "She talks to children like they are human beings." Dotto's core message isn't a parenting philosophy. It doesn't come with a lot of specific instructions. But if you accept that children are rational as a first principle, as French society does, then many things begin to shift. If babies understand what you're saying to them, then you can teach them quite a lot, even while they're very young. That includes, for example, how to eat in a restaurant. The future Françoise Dotto was born, Françoise Marette, in 1908, into a large, well-off Catholic family in Paris. On the surface, she had a charmed life, violin lessons, a cook in the kitchen, and peacocks prancing around the backyard. She was groomed to marry well. But Françoise wasn't the discreet and obedient daughter that her parents expected. She wasn't sage comme une image. She was willful, outspoken, and passionately curious about the people around her. In her early letters, the young Dotto seems preternaturally aware of the troubling gap of understanding between herself and her parents. At age 8, she resolved to become a doctor of education, who intermediates between adults and children. It was a job that didn't yet exist, but that she later created. Having a profession was suddenly becoming possible for French women, Like Simone de Beauvoir, who was also born in 1908, Françoise was part of the first generation of girls allowed to take the French baccalauréat, an exam at the end of high school that makes you eligible for university. After passing le bac, Dautot succumbed to her parents' pressure and settled for a nursing degree. It was only when her younger brother Philippe prepared to enter medical school that her parents allowed her to begin her medical studies too, chaperoned by him. She also entered psychoanalysis, which was then still quite unusual. Her family seemed to think this would purge Dautot of her unfeminine ambitions. In a letter to her written in 1934, Dautot's father said he hoped that psychoanalysis would help you to transform your nature and that you will be, as you say, a real woman, which will add charm to your other qualities. But it was psychoanalysis under René Laforge, who founded France's first psychoanalytic institute, that instead liberated Dautot to finally become a doctor of education. She studied both psychoanalysis and pediatrics, and trained in hospitals around France. Unusually for a parenting expert, Dautot was apparently an excellent parent to her own three children. Her daughter Catherine writes of her parents, "They never made us do our homework, for example. However, we did get bawled out, like everyone, when we had the bad grades. I got detention every Thursday for bad behavior. Mom said to me, 'It's too bad for you, it's you who has detention. When you get tired of it, you'll be able to hold your tongue.'" Dautot always maintained an unusually lucid memory of how she had seen the world as a child. She rejected the prevailing view that children should be treated as a collection of physical symptoms. At the time, bedwetters were still attached to pee-pee stops that released electric shocks. Instead, she spoke to children about their lives and assumed that many of their physical symptoms had psychological origins. "And you, what do you think?" she would ask her young patients. Dautot famously insisted that older children pay her at the end of each session with an object, like a stone, to emphasize their independence and accountability. This respect for children resonated strongly with Dautot's students. "She changed everything, and we the students wanted things to change," the psychoanalyst Myriam Séger recalls. Dautot's respect extended even to babies. A former student described her dealing with an upset infant who was several months old. "All of her senses on alert, totally receptive to the emotions that the baby aroused in her. It was not to console the baby, but to understand what the baby was telling her, or more precisely, what the baby saw." There are legendary stories about Dautot approaching previously inconsolable infants in the hospital and simply explaining to them why they were there and where their parents were. According to legend, the babies suddenly calmed down. This isn't American-style talking to babies, where you believe that babies recognize a mother's voice or are soothed by a calming sound. Nor is it a method to teach a child to speak or to prime him to become the next Jonathan Franzen. Rather, Dautot insisted that the content of what you say to a baby matters tremendously. She said it was crucial that parents tell their babies the truth in order to gently affirm what the babies already know. In fact, she thought that babies begin eavesdropping on adult conversations and intuiting the problems and conflicts swirling around them from the womb. She envisioned, in the pre-sonogram days, a conversation between a mother and her minutes-old baby going something like this. "You see, we were waiting for you. You're a little boy. Maybe you heard us saying that we wanted a little girl, but we're very happy that you're a little boy." Dautot wrote that a child should be included in conversations about his parents' divorce from the age of 6 months. When a grandparent dies, she said that even a young child should briefly attend the funeral. "Someone in the family goes with him to say, 'Voilà, it's the burial of your grandfather.' It's something that happens in a society." For Dautot, the child's best interest is not always what will make him or her happy, but rational understanding, wrote MIT sociologist Sherry Turkle in an introduction to Dautot's When Parents Separate. Turkle writes that what a child most needs, according to Dautot, is a structured inner life able to support autonomy and further growth. Dulto was criticized by some foreign psychoanalysts for relying too much on her own intuition, but inside France, parents seemed to take both an intellectual and an aesthetic pleasure in her imaginative leaps. If Dulto's ideas ever reached English-speaking parents, they probably just sounded strange. American parents were under the sway of Dr. Spock, who was born 5 years before Dulto and also trained as a psychoanalyst. Spock wrote that a child can understand that he's about to have a baby brother or sister only from the age of about 18 months. His forte was listening carefully to parents, not to babies. "Trust yourself. You know more than you think you do," is the famous opening salvo of his parenting guide, Baby and Child Care. For Dulto, it was children who knew more than anyone thought. Even into old age, when she was hooked to an oxygen tank, Dulto would get down on the floor with her young patients to see the world as they did. Her view from there was appealingly blunt. "If there's no jealousy when the baby comes, it's a very bad sign. The older child should show signs of jealousy, because for him, it is a problem. The first time that he sees everyone admiring someone younger than him," she said. Dulto insisted that children have rational motives, even when they misbehave, and she said that it's the job of parents to listen and grasp these motives. "The child who has an unusual reaction always has a reason for having it. Our task is to understand what has happened," she says. Dulto gives the example of a small child who suddenly refuses to continue walking down the street. To the parent, it just seems like sudden stubbornness, but to the child, there's a reason. "We should try to understand him and say, 'There's a reason. I don't understand, but let's think about it. Above all, don't suddenly make a drama out of it.'" In one of the centennial tributes to Dulto, a French psychoanalyst summed up Dulto's teachings this way. "Human beings speak to other human beings. Some of them are big, some of them are small, but they communicate." Spock's giant tome, Baby and Child Care, seems like it's straining to contain every possible scenario involving children, from obstructed tear ducts to, in posthumous editions, gay parenting. But Dulto's books are pocket-sized. Instead of giving lots of specific instructions, she keeps returning to a few basic principles and seems to expect that parents will think things through on their own. Dulto agreed to do the radio broadcasts on the condition that she could answer letters from parents rather than phone calls. She thought that parents would begin to see solutions simply by writing out their problems, Pradel, the radio host, remembers. "She told me, 'You'll see, one day, we'll get a letter from a person who's going to say to us, I'm sending you these pages, but I think I already understand.' And we received one exactly like she predicted." Like Spock in the United States, Dulto has been blamed in France for unleashing a wave of overly permissive parenting, especially in the 1970s and 80s. It's easy to see how her advice could be interpreted this way. Some parents surely thought that if they listened to what a child said, then they had to do what he said. This wasn't what Dulto advocated. She thought that parents should listen carefully to their kids and explain the world to them. But she thought that this world would of course include many limits, and that the child, being rational, could absorb and handle these limits. She didn't want to upend Rousseau's cadre model. She wanted to preserve it. She just added a huge measure of empathy and respect for the child, something that may have been lacking in France pre-1968. The parents I see in Paris today really do seem to have found a balance between listening to their kids and being clear that it's the parents who are in charge, even if they sometimes have to remind themselves of this. French parents listen to their kids all the time, but if little Agathe says she wants pain au chocolat for lunch, she isn't going to get it. French parents have made Dulto, standing on the shoulders of Rousseau, part of their parenting firmament. "When a baby has a nightmare, you always reassure him by speaking to him," says Alexandra, who works in the Parisian daycare. "I'm very much in favor of speech and language with children, even the smallest ones, They understand for me. They understand. The French magazine Parents says that if a baby is scared of strangers, his mother should warn him that a visitor will be coming over soon. Then, when the doorbell rings, tell him that the guest is here. Take a few seconds before opening the door. If he doesn't cry when he sees a stranger, don't forget to congratulate him. I hear of several cases where, upon bringing a baby home from the maternity hospital, French parents give the baby a tour of the house. French parents often just tell babies what they're doing to them. I'm picking you up. I'm changing your diaper. I'm getting ready to give you a bath. This isn't just to make soothing sounds. It's to convey information. And since the baby is a person, like any other, parents are often quite polite to him. Plus, it's apparently never too early to start instilling good manners. The practical implications of believing that a baby or toddler understands what you say and can act on it are considerable. It means you can teach him to sleep through the night early on, to not barge into your room every morning, to sit properly at the table, to eat only at mealtimes, and to not interrupt his parents. You can expect him to accommodate, at least a little bit, what his parents need, too. I get a strong taste of this when Bean is about 10 months old. She begins pulling herself up in front of a bookcase in our living room and pulling down all the books she can reach. This is irritating, of course, but I don't think I can stop her. Often I just pick up the books and put them back. But one morning, Simon's French friend, Lara, is visiting. When Lara sees Bean pulling the books down, she immediately kneels next to her and explains, patiently but firmly, "We don't do that." Then she shows Bean how to put the books back on the shelf and tells her to leave them there. Lara keeps using the French word, doucement, gently. After this, I start to notice that French parents say doucement all the time. I'm shocked when Bean listens to Lara and obeys. This incident revealed the enormous cultural gap between Lara and me as parents. I had assumed that Bean was a very cute, very wild creature with a lot of potential, but almost no self-control. If she occasionally behaved well, it was because of a kind of animalistic training, or just luck. After all, she couldn't talk, and didn't even have hair yet. But Lara, who at the time was childless, but now has two well-behaved daughters, assumed that, even at 10 months old, Bean could understand language and learn to control herself. She believed that Bean could do things doucement if she wanted to, and as a result, Bean did. Doto died in 1988. Some of her intuitions about babies are now being confirmed by scientific experiments. Scientists have figured out that you can tell what babies know by measuring how long they look at one thing versus another. Like adults, babies look longer at things that surprise them. Beginning in the early 1990s, research using this method has shown that babies can do rudimentary math with objects, and that babies have an actual understanding of mental life. They have some grasp of how people think and why they act as they do, writes Yale psychologist Paul Bloom. A study at the University of British Columbia found that 8-month-olds understand probabilities. There's also evidence that babies have a moral sense. Bloom and other researchers showed 6- and 10-month-old babies a sort of puppet show in which a circle was trying to roll up a hill. A helper character helped the circle go up while a hinderer pushed it down. After the show, the babies were offered the helper and the hinderer on a tray. Almost all of them reached for the helper. Babies are drawn to the nice guy and repelled by the mean guy, Paul Bloom explains. Of course, these experiments don't prove that, as Dolto claims, babies understand speech. But they do seem to prove her point that, from a very young age, babies are rational. Their minds aren't a blooming, buzzing confusion. At the very least, we should watch what we say to them. Chapter 6. Daycare. When I call my mother to tell her that Bean has been accepted into a daycare center run by the city of Paris, there's a long pause on her end of the line. Daycare? She asks finally. Friends back home are skeptical, too. "It's just not a situation I want," sniffs a friend, whose son is 9 months old, about the same age Bean will be when she starts daycare. "I want him to have a little more individual attention." But when I tell my French neighbors that Bean has been accepted to the creche, as the full-time daycares are known here, they congratulate me and practically crack open the champagne. It's the sharpest difference between the countries I've seen so far. Middle-class mothers in the United States generally aren't fans of daycare. The very words, daycare, conjure images of pedophiles and howling babies in dirty, dimly lit rooms. "I want him to have a little more individual attention," is a euphemism for, "Unlike you, I actually love my child and don't want to institutionalize him." American parents who can afford it tend to hire full-time nannies, then start easing their kids into preschool when they're 2 or 3. Those who must send their kids to daycare do so warily and often full of guilt. But middle-class French parents, architects, doctors, fellow journalists, are clawing past one another to get a spot in their neighborhood creche, which is open 5 days a week, usually from 8 to 6. Mothers apply when they're pregnant, then harangue, cajole, and beg. Creches are subsidized by the state, and parents are charged sliding fees based on their incomes. "I felt that it was a perfect system, absolutely perfect," gushes my friend Esther, a French lawyer whose daughter started at the creche when she was 9 months old. Even friends of mine who don't work try to enroll their kids in the creche. As a distant second choice, they consider part-time daycare or nannies, which are subsidized too. Government websites give all the options. All this gives me a kind of cultural vertigo. Will daycare make my child aggressive, neglected, and insecurely attached, as the scary American headlines say? Or will she be socialized, awakened, and skillfully looked after, as French parents assure me? For the first time, I worry that we're taking our little intercultural experiment too far. It's one thing to start holding a fork in my left hand and giving blank looks to strangers. It's quite another to subject my child to a potentially weird and damaging experience for the bulk of her toddlerhood. Are we going a bit too native? Bean can try foie gras, but should she try the creche? I decide to read up on this daycare with a funny name. Why is it even called a creche? I thought that was the name for a nativity scene. It turns out that the story of the French creche began in the 1840s. Jean-Baptiste Firmin Marbeau, an ambitious young lawyer in search of a cause to champion, was deputy mayor of Paris's first district. It was the middle of the Industrial Revolution, and cities like Paris were teeming with women who'd arrive from the provinces to work as seamstresses and in factories. Marbeau was charged with writing a study of the salle d'asile, free nursery schools for kids aged 2 to 6. He was impressed. "How carefully," I said to myself, "society watches over the children of the poor," he wrote. But Marbeau wondered who looked after poor children between birth and age 2 while their mothers worked. He consulted the district's poor list and set off to visit several mothers. "At the far end of a filthy backyard, I call out for Madame Gerard, a washerwoman. She comes down, not wanting me to enter her home. Too dirty to be seen. Those are her words. She holds a newborn baby on her arm and a child of 18 months by the hand." Marbeau discovered that when Madame Gerard went off to wash laundry, she left her children with a babysitter. This cost her 70 centimes a day, about a third of her daily wages. And the babysitter was an equally poor woman who, when Marbeau visited, was at her post, watching over 3 young children on the floor in a shabby room. That wasn't bad child care by the day's standards for the poor. Some mothers locked kids alone in apartments or tied them to bedposts for the day. Slightly older kids were often left to watch their siblings while their mothers worked. Many very young babies still lived at the homes of wet nurses, where conditions could be life-threatening. Marbeau was seized with an idea, the creche. The name was meant to invoke the cozy manger in the Christmas story. It would be all-day care for poor children from birth to age two. Funding would come from donations by wealthy patrons, some of whom would also help oversee creches. Marbo envisioned a Spartan but spotless building where women called nurses looked after babies and counseled mothers on hygiene and morals. Mothers would pay just 50 cents a day. Those with unweaned infants would return twice a day to breastfeed. Marbeau's idea struck a chord. There was soon a creche commission to study the matter, and he set off to woo potential donors. Like any good fundraiser, he appealed to both their sense of charity and to their economic self-interest. "These children are your fellow citizens, your brothers. They are poor, unhappy, and weak. You should rescue them," he wrote in a creche manual published in 1845. Then he added, "If you can save the lives of 10,000 children, make haste. 20,000 extra alms a year are not to be disdained. Alms are work, and work creates wealth." The creche was also supposed to give a mother peace of mind, so she could devote herself to her work with an easy conscience. In his manual, Marbeau instructs creches to open from 5:30 a.m. to 8:30 p.m. to cover the typical workday for laborers. The life Marbeau describes for mothers isn't too different from that of a lot of working mothers I know today. She gets up before 5 o'clock, dresses her child, does some housework, runs to the creche, runs to work. At 8 o'clock, she hastens back, fetches her child with the day's dirty linen, rushes home to put the poor little creature to bed, and to wash his linen so it will be dry the next day, and every day the whole process is repeated. How on earth does she manage? Evidently, Marbeau was quite persuasive. The first creche opened in a donated building on the Rue de Chaillot in Paris. 2 years later, there were 13 creches. The number continued to grow, especially in Paris. After World War II, the French government put creches under the control of the newly formed Mother and Infant Protection Service, PMI, and created an official degree program for the job of péricultrice, a person who specialized in caring for babies and young children. By the beginning of the 1960s, the French poor were less desperate, and there were fewer of them. However, more middle-class mothers were working, so the creche began attracting middle-class families, too. The number of spots nearly doubled in 10 years, reaching 32,000 in 1971. Suddenly, middle-class mothers got sulky if they couldn't get a place in a creche. It was starting to seem like an entitlement for working mothers. All kinds of variants on the creche opened, too. There were part-time daycares, family creches, where parents pitched in, and company creches for employees. Guided by Françoise Dolto's insistence that babies are people, too, there was a new interest in child care that didn't merely keep kids from getting sick or treat them like potential delinquents. Soon, creches were spouting middle-class values like socialization and awakening. I first hear about the creche when I'm pregnant from my friend Dietland. She's a Chicagoan who's lived in Europe since she graduated from college. In Paris, there's a whole cast of semester-abroad expatriates who married their junior-year boyfriends or just never got around to leaving. Dietland is warm, speaks effortless French, and still charmingly refers to herself as a feminist. She's one of the few people I know who's actually striving to make the world a better place. About the only thing wrong with Dietland is that she can't cook. Her family subsists almost entirely on food from Picard, the French frozen food chain. She once tried to serve me defrosted sushi, rice and all. Despite this, Dietland is a model mother. So when she tells me that her two sons, ages 5 and 8, attended the creche around the corner from me, I take note. She says the creche was excellent. Years later, she still stops by to greet the directrice and her son's old teachers. The boys still talk about their creche days with joyful nostalgia. Their favorite caregiver used to give them haircuts. What's more, Dietland offers to put in a good word with the directrice. She keeps repeating to me that the creche isn't fancy. I'm not sure what this means. Does she think that I require Philippe Stark playpens? Is not fancy code for dirty? Though I put up a brave multicultural front for my mother, the truth is, that I share some of her doubts. The fact that the creche is run by the city of Paris seems kind of creepy. It feels like I'll be dropping my baby off at the post office or the Department of Motor Vehicles. I have visions of faceless bureaucrats rushing past Bean's bassinet as she weeps. Maybe I do want fancy, whatever that means. Or maybe I just want to look after Bean myself. Unfortunately, I can't. I'm midway through writing the book that I was supposed to hand in before Bean was born. I took a few months off after her birth, but now my already once extended deadline looms. We've hired a lovely nanny, Adeline, from the Philippines, who shows up in the morning and looks after Bean all day. The problem is, I work from home in a little alcove office. The temptation to micromanage them both, to the irritation of everyone, is irresistible. Bean does seem to be developing a decent passive understanding of Tagalog, the main language of the Philippines, but I suspect that Adeline often ends up speaking Tagalog to her at our local McDonald's, since each time we pass by it, Bean points and shouts. Perhaps a non-fancy creche is a better option. I'm also amazed that, thanks to Dietland, we have an inn somewhere. I'm used to being out of sync with the rest of the country. Sometimes I don't know it's a national holiday until I walk outside and find that all the shops are closed. Having been in a creche would connect us more to France. The creche is also tantalizingly convenient. There's one across the street from our house. Dietland's is a 5-minute walk. Like those 19th century washerwomen, I could pop in to breastfeed Bean and wipe her snot. Mostly, though, it's hard to resist all this French adult peer pressure. I'm glad they're not trying to get me to smoke. Anne and the other French mothers in our courtyard chime in about the wonders of the creche, too. Simon and I figure that even with our inn, our odds of actually getting in are small. So we go to our local town hall and apply for a spot. Why are middle-class Americans so skeptical of daycare? The answer has its roots in the 19th century, too. By the middle of the 1800s, news of Mabot's creches reached America, which had its own horror stories about poor kids being tied to bedposts. Curious philanthropists and social activists traveled to Paris. They were impressed. Over the following decades, charity-financed creches opened in Boston, New York, Philadelphia, and Buffalo for the children of poor, working mothers. A few used the French name, but most were called day nurseries. By the 1890s, there were 90 American day nurseries. Many cared for the children of recent immigrants. They were supposed to keep these kids off the streets and turn them into Americans. At the beginning of the 20th century, there was a separate nursery school movement in America to create private preschools and kindergartens for children aged around 2 to 6. These grew out of new ideas about the importance of early learning and of stimulating kids' social and emotional development. From the start, they appealed to middle and upper middle class American parents. The separate origins of daycare and preschool explain why, more than 100 years later, daycare still has a working class connotation in America, while middle-class parents battle to get their 2-year-olds into preschool. It also explains why today's American preschools often last just a few hours a day. It's presumed that mothers of the students don't have to work or can afford nannies. One segment of American society that isn't ambivalent about daycare is the U.S. military. The Department of Defense runs America's largest daycare system, with about 800 child development centers, or CDCs, on military installations around the world. The centers accept kids from the age of 6 weeks and are typically open from 6 a.m. to 6:30 p.m. The American military's daycare system looks remarkably like the French creche. Operating hours wrap around the workday. Fees are scaled according to parents' combined income. The government subsidizes about half the cost. And, like the French creche, the military's daycare centers are so popular they usually have long waiting lists. But outside the military, middle-class American parents remain ambivalent about daycare. This is partly an issue of nomenclature. If you call it early childhood education, 0 through 5, they think it's worthwhile, says Sheila Kammerman, a professor at Columbia University who's been tracking daycare for decades. These days, it's often simply called childcare. Americans remain consumed by the question of how even normal daycare affects a child's fragile psyche. There are headlines on whether daycare causes learning delays, makes kids more aggressive, or leaves them insecurely attached to their mothers. I know American moms who quit their jobs rather than subject their kids to daycare. They are often right to worry, since the quality of American daycare is extremely uneven. There are no national regulations. Some states don't require caregivers to have any training. The U.S. Department of Labor says childcare workers earn less than janitors, and that dissatisfaction with benefits, pay, and stressful working conditions cause many to leave the industry. Annual turnover rates of 35% are common. There are some good daycare centers, of course, but these can be extremely expensive or limited to employees of certain companies, and bad centers are amply in evidence, with poor kids getting especially bad care. Other centers, usually the expensive ones, treat babyhood like a college prep course. Perhaps to calm nervous parents, a Colorado-based company boasts that, in its centers, children under the age of one are taught literacy. French mothers are convinced that the crèche is good for their kids. In Paris, about a third of kids under the age of three go to the crèche, and half are in some kind of collective care. There are still fewer crèches outside Paris. French mothers do worry about pedophiles, but not at the crèche. They think kids are safer in settings with lots of trained adults looking after them, rather than being alone with a stranger, according to a report by a national group that advocates for parents. "If she's going to be tête-à-tête with someone, I want it to be me," the mother of an 18-month-old at Bean's crèche tells me. The mother says if she hadn't gotten a spot in the crèche, she would have quit her job. French mothers do worry about the anguish they'll feel when they drop their children off at a crèche for the first time, but they view this as their own separation issue. "In France, parents are not afraid of sending their children to the crèche," explains Marie Wierink, a sociologist with France's Ministry of Labor. "Au contraire, they fear that if they cannot find a place in the crèche, the child will be missing out on something." Kids don't learn to read in a crèche. They don't learn letters or other pre-literacy skills. What they do is socialize with other kids. In America, some parents mention this to me as a benefit of daycare. In France, all parents do. "I knew that it was very good. It was an opening to social life," says my friend Esther, the lawyer, whose daughter entered a crèche at 9 months old. French parents take for granted that crèches are of universally high quality and that the members of their staffs are caring and highly skilled. In French parenting chat rooms, the most serious complaint I can find about a crèche is from a mother whose child was served ravioli along with moussaka, a similarly heavy dish. "I sent a letter to the crèche, and they responded to me saying their regular chef was not there," she explains. She adds darkly, "Let's see what happens the rest of the week." This certainty that the crèche is good for kids erases a lot of maternal guilt and doubt. My friend Hélène, an engineer, didn't work during the first few years after her youngest daughter was born. But she was never remotely apologetic about sending the little girl to the crèche 5 days a week. This was in part so that Hélène could have time to herself, but also because she didn't want her daughter to miss out on the communal experience. The main question people in France ask about daycare is how to get more kids into it. Thanks to France's current baby boom, you can't run for public office in France, on the right or the left, without promising to build more crèches or expand existing ones. I read about a program to turn disused baggage areas and train stations into crèches for the children of commuters. Much of the construction cost would go toward soundproofing. Competition for the existing spots in a crèche is, as the French say, énergique. A committee of bureaucrats and crèche directors in each of Paris's 20 arrondissements convenes to dole out their available spots. In the well-heeled 16th arrondissement, there are 4,000 applicants for 500 spots. in our less rarefied area in eastern Paris, the odds of getting a spot are 1 in 3. Scrambling for a spot in a creche is one of the initiation rituals of new parenting. In Paris, women can officially begin petitioning the town hall when they're 6 months pregnant. But magazines urge women to schedule a meeting with the director of their preferred creche as soon as they have a positive pregnancy test. Priority goes to single parents, multiple births, adoptees, households with 3 or more kids, or families with particular difficulties. How to fit into this last ambiguous category is a topic of furious speculation in online forums. One mother advises writing to town hall officials about your urgent need to return to work and your epic but ultimately failed efforts to find any other form of childcare. She suggests copying this letter to the regional governor and the president of France, then requesting a private audience with the district mayor.
You go there with the baby in your arms, looking desperate, and you retell the same story as in the letter, she says. I can assure you that this will work.
Simon and I decide to work our only angle, being foreign. In a letter attached to our creche application, we extol Bean's budding multilingualism, she doesn't actually speak yet, and describe how her Anglo-Americanism will enrich the creche. As promised, Dietlin talks us up to the director of the creche that her sons went to. I meet with this woman and try to project a mix of desperation and charm. I call the town hall once a month. For some reason, as with French couples, most of the creche courting falls to me, to remind them of our enormous interest and need for a spot. Since I'm not French and can't vote here, I decide not to bother the president. Amazingly, these attempts to massage the process actually work. A congratulatory letter arrives from our town hall explaining that Bean has been assigned a spot in a creche for mid-September when she'll be 9 months old. I call Simon triumphant. We foreigners have beaten the natives at their own game. We're amazed and giddy from the victory. But we also have the feeling that we won a prize that we don't quite deserve and aren't even sure we want. I still have my doubts when we take Bean to her first day of creche. It's at the end of a dead-end street, in a 3-story concrete building with a little astroturf courtyard out front. It looks like a public school in America, but with everything in miniature. I recognize some of the kids' furniture from the IKEA catalog. It's not fancy, but it's cheerful and clean. The kids are divided by age into sections called small, medium, and large. Bean's class is in a sunlit room with play kitchens, tiny furniture, and cubbyholes full of age-appropriate toys. Attached to the room is a glassed-in sleeping area where each child has his own crib, stocked with his pacifier, and stuffed animal companion, called a doudou. Anne-Marie, who'll be Bean's main caregiver, greets us. She's the same lady who gave haircuts to Dietlin's sons. Anne-Marie is a grandmother in her 60s, with short blonde hair and a rotating collection of printed T-shirts from places her charges have traveled to. We'll eventually bring her one attesting to her love of Brooklyn. Employees have worked at the creche for an average of 13 years. Anne-Marie has been there much longer. She and most of the other caregivers are trained as auxiliaires de périculture, which has no exact American equivalent. A pediatrician and a psychologist each visit the creche once a week. The caregivers chart Bean's daily naps and poops and report to me about how she's eaten. They feed the kids Bean's age one at a time, with the child either on someone's lap or in a bouncy seat. They put the kids down to sleep at roughly the same time each day and claim not to wake them up. For this initial adaptation period, Anne-Marie asks me to bring in a shirt that I've worn so that Bean can sleep with it. This feels a bit canine, but I do it. I'm struck by the confidence that Anne-Marie and the other caregivers have. They're quite certain about what children of each age need, and they're equally confident in their abilities to provide this. They convey this without being smug or impatient. My one gripe is that Anne-Marie insists on calling me Mother of Bean rather than Pamela. She says it's too difficult to learn the names of all the parents. Given our doubts about daycare, we've compromised by enrolling Bean just 4 days a week, from about 9:30 to 3:30. Plenty of her classmates will be there 5 days a week for much longer each day. The creche is open from 7:30 to 6. As in Marvaux's day, Bean is supposed to arrive with a clean diaper. This becomes an almost Talmudic point of discussion between Simon and me. What constitutes arrival? If Bean poops on her way in the door, or while we're saying goodbye, who changes the offending diaper? Is it us or the auxiliaires? The first 2 weeks are an adaptation period, in which she stays for increasingly long periods at the creche, with and without us. She cries a bit each time I leave, but Anne-Marie assures me that she quiets down soon after I go. Often one of the caregivers holds her up at the window facing the street so I can wave when I get outside. If the creche is damaging Bean, we can't tell. Pretty soon she's cheerful when we drop her off and happy when we pick her up. Once Bean has been at the creche for a while, I begin to notice that the place is a microcosm of French parenting. That includes the bad stuff. Anne-Marie and the other caregivers are mystified that I'm still nursing Bean when she's 9 months old, and especially when I nurse her on the premises. They're not thrilled with my short-lived plan to drop off pumped breast milk before lunch each day, though they don't try to stop me. But all the big positive French parenting ideas are in evidence, too. Since there's so much agreement anyway on the best way to do things, French parents don't have to worry that the caregivers aren't following their personal parenting philosophy. For the most part, the caregivers reinforce the same schedule and habits as parents. For example, the caregivers talk to even very young children all the time at the creche, with what seems like perfect conviction that the children understand. And there's a lot of talk about the cadre. At a parents' meeting, one of the teachers speaks almost poetically about it. Everything is very un cadre, built into a framework, the hour that they arrive and leave, for example. But inside this framework, we try to introduce flexibility, fluidity, and spontaneity for the children and also for the teaching team. Bean spends a lot of the day just ambling around the room, playing with whatever she wants. I'm concerned about this. Where are the music circles and organized activities? I soon realize that all this freedom is by design. It's the French cadre model yet again. Kids get firm boundaries, but lots of freedom within those boundaries, and they're supposed to learn to cope with boredom and to play by themselves. When the child plays, he constructs himself, Sylvie, another of Bean's caregivers, tells me. A mayor's report on Parisian creches calls for a spirit of energetic discovery, in which the children are left to exercise their appetite for experimentation of their five senses, of using their muscles, of sensations, and of physical space. As kids get older, they do have some organized activities, but no one is obliged to participate. We propose, we don't force, another of Bean's teachers explains. There's soothing background music to launch the kids into their naps and a pile of books that they can read in bed. The kids gradually wake up to their goûter, the afternoon snack. The creche isn't the Department of Motor Vehicles. It's more like Canyon Ranch. In the playground, there are a few rules, also by design. The idea is to give kids as much freedom as possible. When they're outside, we intervene very little, says Marie, another one of Bean's caregivers. If we intervene all the time, they go a little nuts. The creche also teaches kids patience. I watch as a 2-year-old demands that Marie pick her up, but Marie is cleaning up the table where the children have just had lunch. For the moment, I'm not free. You wait 2 seconds, Marie says gently to the little girl. Then she turns to me and explains. We try to teach them to wait. It's very important. They can't have everything right away. The caregivers speak calmly and respectfully to the kids, using the language of rights. You have the right to do this. You don't have the right to do that. They say this with that same utter conviction that I've heard in the voices of French parents. Everyone believes that for the cadre to seem immutable, it has to be consistent.
The prohibitions are always consistent, and we always give a reason for them, Sylvie tells me. I know the Creche is strict about certain things because, after a while, Bean repeats phrases she's learned. We know they're Creche phrases because the teachers there are her only source of French. It's like she's been wearing a wire all day, and now we get to listen to the tape. Most of what Bean repeats is in the command form, like, On va pas crier! We're not going to scream. My rhyming favorites, which I immediately begin using at home, are Couche-toi! Go to sleep, and Mouche-toi! Blow your nose, said when you're holding a tissue up to a child's face. For a while, Bean speaks French only in the command form, or in these declarations of what's permissible and what isn't. When she plays teacher at home, she stands on a chair, wags her finger, and shouts instructions to imaginary children, or occasionally to our surprised lunch guests. Soon, in addition to commands, Bean is coming home with songs. She often sings one that we know only as Tomola, Tomola, Vatovi, in which she sings more and more loudly with each line, while making a spinning motion with her arms. It's only later that I learn this is one of the most popular French children's songs, which actually goes, Ton moulin, ton moulin, va trop vite, about a windmill that's going too fast. What really wins us over about the Creche is the food, or more specifically, the dining experience. Each Monday, the Creche posts its menu for the week on a giant white board near the entrance. I sometimes photograph these menus and email them to my mother. They read like the chalkboard menus at Parisian brasseries. Lunch is served in four courses, a cold vegetable starter, a main dish with a side of grains or cooked vegetables, a different cheese each day, and a dessert of fresh fruit or fruits purée. There's a slightly modified version for each age group. The youngest kids mostly have the same foods, but pureed. A typical menu starts with hearts of palm and tomato salad. This is followed by sliced turkey, au basilic, accompanied by rice, in a Provençal cream sauce. The third course is a slice of Saint-Nectaire cheese with a slice of fresh baguette. Dessert is fresh kiwi. An in-house cook at each Creche prepares lunch from scratch each day. A truck arrives several times a week with seasonal fresh, sometimes even organic, ingredients. Aside from the occasional can of tomato paste, nothing is processed or pre-cooked. A few vegetables are frozen, but never pre-cooked. I have trouble imagining two-year-olds sitting through a meal like this, so the Creche lets me sit in on lunch one Wednesday when Bean is home with a babysitter. I'm stunned when I realize how my daughter eats lunch most days. I sit quietly with my reporter's notebook while her classmates assemble in groups of four at square, toddler-sized tables. One of her teachers wheels up a cart filled with covered serving plates and bread wrapped in plastic to keep it fresh. There's a teacher at each table. First, the teacher uncovers and displays each dish. The starter is a bright red tomato salad in vinaigrette. This is followed by le poisson, she says to approving glances, as she displays a flaky white fish in a light butter sauce and a side dish of peas, carrots, and onions. Next, she previews the cheese course. Today, it's le bleu, she says, showing the kids a crumbly blue cheese. Then she shows them dessert, whole apples, which she'll slice at the table. The food looks simple, fresh, and appetizing. Except for the melamine plates, the bite-sized pieces, and the fact that some of the diners have to be prodded to say merci, I might be in a high-end restaurant. Just who are the people taking care of Bean? To find out, I show up one windy fall morning at the annual entrance examination for ABC, Péricouture, one of the schools that train Creche workers. There are hundreds of nervous women, and a few men in their 20s, who are looking shyly at one another or doing last-minute practice questions in thick workbooks. They're understandably anxious. Of the more than 500 people who sit for this test, just 30 will be admitted to the training school. Applicants are grilled on reasoning, reading comprehension, math, and human biology. Those who advance to the second round face a psychological exam, an oral presentation, and interrogation by a panel of experts. The 30 winners
then do a year of coursework and internships, following a curriculum set by the government. They learn the basics of child nutrition, sleep, and hygiene, and practice mixing baby formula and changing diapers. They'll do additional week-long trainings throughout their careers. In France, working in daycare is a career. There are schools all over the country with similarly rigorous entrance standards, creating an army of skilled workers to staff the creches. Just half of caregivers at a creche must be auxiliaires or have a similar degree. A quarter must have degrees related to health, leisure, or social work. A quarter are exempt from any qualifications but must be trained in-house. At Bean's creche, 13 of the 16 caregivers are auxiliaires or similar. I start to see Anne-Marie and other caregivers at Bean's creche as the Rhodes Scholars of baby care. And I understand their confidence. They've mastered a field and earned the respect of parents, and I'm indebted to them. During nearly 3 years that Bean is at the creche, they potty train her, teach her table manners, and give her a French immersion course. By Bean's third year at the creche, I suspect that the days are starting to feel long and that perhaps she's not being stimulated enough. I'm ready for her to move on to preschool, but Bean still seems to like the creche. She chatters all the time about Mackie and Lila, her two best friends. Interestingly, she's gravitated to other children of foreigners. Lila's parents are Moroccan and Japanese. Mackie's dad is from Senegal. She has definitely been socialized. When Simon and I take Bean to Barcelona for a long weekend, she keeps asking where the other children are. The kids in Bean's section spend a lot of time running around and shouting in the AstroTurf courtyard, which is stocked with little scooters and carts. Bean is usually out there when I pick her up. As soon as she spots me, she bolts over and bursts happily into my arms, shouting the news of the day. On Bean's last day at the creche, after the goodbye party and the clearing out of her locker, Bean gives a big hug and kiss goodbye to Sylvie, who's been her main caregiver. Sylvie has been the model of professionalism all year, but when Bean embraces her, Sylvie begins to cry. I cry too. By the end of creche, Simon and I feel that Bean has had a good experience. But we did often feel guilty dropping her off each day, and we can't help but notice the drip of alarming headlines in the American press about how daycare affects kids. Continental Europeans aren't really asking about that anymore. Sheila Kammerman at Columbia says that Europeans pretty much take for granted that high-quality daycare, with small groups and warm, well-trained caregivers who have made the job a career, are good for kids. And conversely, they assume that bad daycare is bad for kids. Americans have too many misgivings about daycare to take this for granted. So the U.S. government has funded the largest ever study of how early childcare arrangements correlate with the way kids develop and behave later in life. Many of the headlines on daycare in America come out of data from this giant study. One of its principal findings is that early childcare arrangements just aren't very significant. Parenting quality is a much more important predictor of child development than type, quantity, or quality of childcare, explains a backgrounder. Children fared better when their parents were more educated and wealthier, when they had books and play materials at home, and when they had enhancing experiences, like going to the library. This was the same whether the child went to daycare for 30 or more hours a week or had a stay-at-home mother. And as I mentioned earlier, the study found that what's especially crucial is a mother's sensitivity, how attuned she is to her child's experience of the world. This is also true at daycare. One of the study's researchers writes that kids get high-quality daycare when the caregiver is attentive to the child's needs, responsive to her verbal and nonverbal signals and cues, stimulating of his curiosity and desire to learn about the world, and emotionally warm, supportive, and caring. Kids fared better with a caregiver who was sensitive, whether it was a nanny, a grandparent, or a daycare worker. It would not be possible to go into a classroom and, with no additional information, pick out which children had been in center care, the researcher writes. I realize that what we Americans should be fretting about isn't just whether bad daycare has bad outcomes. Of course it does. but how unpleasant it is for kids to be in bad daycare. We're so concerned about cognitive development that we're forgetting to ask whether children in daycare are happy and whether it's a positive experience for them while it's happening. That's what French parents are talking about. Even my mother gets used to the creche. She starts calling it the creche instead of daycare, which probably helps. The creche certainly has benefits for us. We feel more like we're part of France, or at least part of our neighborhood. Thankfully, we put our ongoing to stay or not to stay in Paris conversation on pause. We can't really imagine moving someplace where we'd struggle to find decent, affordable childcare. And we can see the next excuse for staying in France coming down the pike. The École Maternelle, free public preschool, with spots for just about everyone. Mostly, we like the French crèche because Bean likes it. She eats blue cheese, shares her toys, and plays tomate ketchup, a French version of